his head was full of the frothy stuff of the new imperialism. He signalized his accession by an address to his army and navy. His address to his people followed 3 days later. A high note of contempt for democracy was sounded. The soldier and the army, not parliamentary majorities, have welded together the German Empire. My trust is placed in the army. So the patient work of the German schoolmasters was disowned, and the Hohenzollern declared himself triumphant. The next exploit of the young monarch was to quarrel with the old Chancellor, Bismarck, who had made the new German Empire, and to dismiss him in 1890. There were no profound differences of opinion between them, but, as Bismarck said, the Emperor intended to be his own Chancellor. These were the opening acts of an active and aggressive career. This William II meant to make a noise in the world, a louder noise than any other monarch had ever made. The whole of Europe was soon familiar with the figure of the new monarch, invariably in military uniform of the most glittering sort, staring valiantly, fiercely moustached, and with a withered left arm ingeniously minimized. He affected silver shining breastplates and long white cloaks. A great restlessness was manifest. It was clear he conceived himself destined for great things, but for a time it wasn't manifest what particular great things these were. There was no oracle at Delphi now to tell him that he was destined to destroy a great empire. The note of theatricality about him and the dismissal of Bismarck alarmed many of his subjects, but they were presently reassured by the idea that he was using his influence in the cause of peace and to consolidate Germany. He travelled much to London, Vienna, Rome, where he had private conversations with the Pope, to Athens, where his sister married the king in 1889, and to Constantinople. He was the first Christian sovereign to be a sultan's guest. He also went to Palestine. A special gate was knocked through the ancient wall of Jerusalem so that he could ride into that place. It was beneath his dignity to walk in. He induced the sultan to commence the reorganization of the Turkish army upon German lines and under German officers. In 1895 he announced that Germany was a world power, and that the future of Germany lay upon the water, regardless of the fact that the British considered that they were there already, and he began to interest himself more and more in the building up of a great navy. He also took German art and literature under his care. He used his influence to retain the distinctive and blinding German black letter against the Roman type used by the rest of Western Europe, and he supported the pan-German movement, which claimed the Dutch, the Scandinavians, the Flemish Belgians, and the German Swiss as members of a great German brotherhood, as in fact good assimilable stuff for a hungry young empire which meant to grow. All other monarchs in Europe paled before him. He used the general hostility against Britain aroused throughout Europe by the war against the Boer republics to press forward his schemes for a great navy, and this, together with the rapid and challenging extension of the German colonial empire in Africa and the Pacific Ocean, alarmed and irritated the British extremely. British liberal opinion in particular found itself under the exasperating necessity of supporting an ever-increasing British navy. "I will not rest," he said, "until I've brought my navy to the same height at which my army stands." The most peace-loving of the islanders couldn't ignore that threat. In 1890 he had acquired the small island of Heligoland from Britain. This he made into a great naval fortress. As his navy grew, his enterprise increased. He proclaimed the Germans the salt of the earth. They mustn't weary in the work of civilization. Germany, like the spirit of Imperial Rome, must expand and impose itself. This, he said, on Polish soil, in support of the steady efforts the Germans were making to suppress the Polish language and culture and to Germanize their share of Poland. God, he described, as his divine ally. In the old absolutisms, the monarch was either God himself or the adopted agent of God. The Kaiser took God for his trusty henchman. Our old God, he said affectionately. When the Germans seized Kiao Trau, he spoke of the German mailed fist. When he backed Austria against Russia, he talked of Germany in her shining armor. The disasters of Russia in Manchuria in 1905 released the spirit of German imperialism to bolder aggressions. The fear of a joint attack from France and Russia seemed lifting. The emperor made a kind of regal progress through the Holy Land, landed at Tangier to assure the Sultan of Morocco of his support against the French, and inflicted upon France the crowning indignity of compelling her by a threat of war to dismiss Delcasse, her foreign minister. He drew tighter the links between Austria and Germany. And in 1908, Austria, with his support, defied the rest of Europe by annexing from the Turk the Yugoslav provinces of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So, by his naval challenge to Britain and these aggressions upon France and the Slavs, he forced Britain, France, and Russia into a defensive understanding against him. The Bosnian annexation had the further effect of estranging Italy, which had hitherto been his ally. Such was the personality that the evil fate of Germany set over her to stimulate, organize, and render intolerable to the rest of the world the natural pride and self-assertion of a great people who had at last, after long centuries of division and weakness, escaped from a jungle of princes to unity and the world's respect. It was natural that the commercial and industrial leaders of this new Germany, who were now getting rich, the financiers, intent upon overseas exploits, the officials and the vulgar, should find this leader very much to their taste. Many Germans, who thought him rash or tawdry in their secret hearts, supported him publicly because he had so taking an air of success. Hoch der Kaiser! Yet Germany didn't yield itself without a struggle to the strong flowing tide of imperialism. Important elements in German life struggled against this swaggering new autocracy. The old German nations, and particularly the Bavarians, refused to be swallowed up in Prussianism. And with the spread of education and the rapid industrialization of Germany, organized labor developed its ideas and a steady antagonism to the military and patriotic clattering of its ruler. A new political party was growing up in the state, the Social Democrats, professing the doctrines of Marx. In the teeth of the utmost opposition from the official and clerical organizations and of violently repressive laws against its propaganda and against combinations, this party grew. The Kaiser denounced it again and again. Its leaders were sent to prison or driven abroad. Still, it grew. When he came to the throne, it polled not half a million votes. In 1907, it polled over 3 million. He attempted to concede many things, old age and sickness insurance, for example, as a condescending gift, things which it claimed for the workers as their right. His conversion to socialism was noted, but it gained no converts to imperialism. His naval ambitions were ably and bitterly denounced. The colonial adventures of the new German capitalists were incessantly attacked by this party of the common sense of the common man, but to the army the Social Democrats accorded a moderate support because, much as they detested their homegrown autocrat, they hated and dreaded the barbaric and retrogressive autocracy of Russia on their eastern frontier more. The danger plainly before Germany was that this swaggering imperialism would compel Britain, Russia, and France into a combined attack upon her, an offensive defensive. The Kaiser wavered between a stiff attitude towards Britain and clumsy attempts to propitiate her, while his fleet grew and while he prepared for a preliminary struggle with Russia and France.